Today is January 2nd, 7th of Tevet, and we're going to be looking at Mitzvot 230 to 233, Bezrat Hashem. So 230. So this is the mitzvah of paying a hired person the day that they worked. So the mitzvah is a negative commandment not to delay the pay of a hired person. And it says it in two different ways in the Torah. One is, you shall not keep the wages of a hired servant with you all night until the morning, meaning the day that they work, you should pay them, right? And the second way of saying it is, on the same day you shall give him his hire, that the sun shall not go down over it. So it's two things. One is, if they work at night, you can pay them within 24 hours, basically. But you have to pay them that day. So if they work at night, you have the following day to pay them, but the sun can't set. If they work that day, you have until the sun rises to pay them. But you have to pay them.
So these are it's intended to be basically people that are hired for a particular job, as opposed to an employee.
Correct, a day laborer, or even if you hire somebody. So then, even if you hire somebody regularly, let's say you have
a cleaning person.
Let's say the cleaning person, right? So you hire them regularly, or let's say they come every day, right? They're your nanny,
right?
A nanny who comes every single
day. So
hang on. Theoretically, they would have to be paid each day, unless you make an arrangement with them to not pay them each day, that you pay them once a week, that you pay them once a month. You can make that arrangement, and that's okay. But if you didn't make an arrangement, you just hired somebody. You have a cleaning lady or a cab driver, right? That's a day laborer, right? It's a mitzvah to pay him right away. Now, that's our culture. You pay right away. It's before you get out of the cab, you're paying. But you could have in mind, while you're handing the money over, that you're fulfilling a mitzvah d'oraita, and then you get a mitzvah besides the fact that you're just paying, right? So anybody that you're paying for their labor, somebody comes to shovel your walk, and you pay them right then. So that is a mitzvah d'oraita, to pay them right away.
So you need to think of it.
You do need to think, think of it. So, and then also, when the person comes to say, can I shovel your walk, and you agree, whatever, $30, where we live on a corner, right? So you make that agreement, then you need to check and make sure that you have that $30 or run out and go get it, because you have to pay them. And if they come and you didn't have it, you would just realize then, so then they can go to the next house, but you have to go then and get it. You have to pay them by the end of that day.
Next time it snows.
No, you can't. No, you have to pay them that day. You can't say come back tomorrow. You have to pay them that day. That is the mitzvah. Right, now the principle that I wrote down here is that, it's interesting, he says, I haven't seen this yet in the book, in the third paragraph.
Through the precept? Oh, no, the substance.
The substance of this precept is that we should not delay the wages of a hired worker, but should pay within a fixed period. This is a basic demand of the precept. And with these two injunctions about it given above, we know that the time period for payment of all hired workers, whether day laborers or night workers, when it is. Now, remember this principle for all the precepts, because it's an important rule in the reckoning of the mitzvah. And it's a rule on which the two pillars of the world are agreed. This is where no dispute. Rambam and Ramban of blessed memory both agree. But so what's the principle? That's not the mitzvah, because of course they both agree it's a mitzvah. They just might disagree on the count. But the principle is, even though it comes from two verses, each verse just completes the other. This is not two different mitzvahs. It's not one mitzvah to pay a night worker by the next sunset. And it's not a separate mitzvah to pay a day worker by the end of the night. It's one mitzvah. So that's the principle that's being agreed, that when you have two, even if you have it written in two separate verses, it's not two separate mitzvahs if they each complement each other to complete the mitzvah. That's the principle upon which they both agree. But we haven't yet seen that they both agree like this. It's interesting to say the two pillars of the world agree.
Right.
So I thought that was an interesting language. But the principle is, when two verses come to complete,
it happens so infrequently.
That's something to point out.
Yeah, right.
Right. Something to point out. And then why I wrote fasting here is because he says that the reason why you have until the end of that period is because the day laborer depends on the wages that he earns that day to buy his food. You have to pay him in time because he relies on it. But it is the normal way of people to delay eating for up to a day. You know, so that's not asking somebody to do something unusual, to wait 12 hours to be paid, to eat or to be paid, you know, because people do that. But you can't ask somebody to wait longer than that. That's not right. So you have to pay within that time period. So it's just something to think about, you know.
And there were a lot of people,
right,
still are, that are really hand-to-mouth.
Really hand-to-mouth. But this is really hand-to-mouth. This is not the kind of hand-to-mouth that we think of in general in this country. But there are people who are
seeing more of it.
Yeah, there's really, really, really. So, and I see it. You know, I have somebody in my life who does kind of work hand-to-mouth. And, you know, if he doesn't get paid, it's very hard for him to not get paid that day or that, certainly that week. Usually it's not a day-to-day thing that he would be hungry on a day, but he'd be hungry in a week, you know, and sometimes has to chase somebody to get paid. And I think about it, you know, that he would have to drive somewhere to go pick up a paycheck instead of the person actually giving it to him. It's just not okay. Right. That is a transgression of this, you know, and people do need it. And that is why, I think I mentioned before, but something to think about, that is why we bring meals to a Shiva house, right, is because somebody who's sitting Shiva can't work.
Can't go out and get.
So they don't have what to eat because they didn't
they
earn money that day.
Right,
so we bring them food. So it comes from that. Today we do it so that they shouldn't be distracted from the Shiva, or it's an act of caring. But it's, some people have translated into thinking that the Shiva person isn't permitted to prepare food. They are. They just didn't have food to prepare if they didn't work that day. They're not really supposed to work. Right, although I would imagine, I'm not positive, that if you wouldn't be able to eat, you still could work enough to be able to eat that day.
Yeah, probably. If nobody,
if there was nobody bringing you, if you lived in...
Right, which happens there, I mean,
Iowa.
Right. Well, so if you lived in Iowa, right, and there's nobody to bring you kosher food, or if you live in Israel and you're a Kollel family and everybody's really living hand-to-mouth, and your neighbors really can't afford it. There's just a whole article in Mishpacha magazine this week about, you know, it's very common to bring meals, and people make phone calls without even thinking twice. Hi, Shandy just had a baby. Can you bring her a meal? But maybe you're calling somebody who really can't afford it, really doesn't have the money.
They don't have the courage to say no.
Right, they don't. So you're really taking food off of their table to bring to Shandy, that people need to think twice before they make that phone call, you know, just, you know.
To be sure that it's the person.
Right, because when people really are, like when they're really living on very little, it could be very, very little. And they don't have enough extra. So something to think about. Okay, so that's Mitzvah 230, that the payment of a hired person is not to be delayed. That's for man and for woman, and it applies to all of us.
Can I just ask you a question? I've been following, I get the weekly thing from the Kollel, you know, and they've been talking a lot about the concept of Baal Tolan. What is that?
Baal Tolan?
Yeah, it has something to do with workers.
Tolan?
Tolan.
Baal
Tolan. T-O-L-I-N. Do you know anything about that?
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. All right. Then never mind.
Work.
Is this in the Jewish Experiment?
No, the Kollel. You know, they have a whole series. They have a whole story. And then now they ask questions or something, the rabbi. And
interesting.
Talking about the concept of workers and Baal Tolan. And so I just...
Interesting.
I wonder
if that has to do with this.
Yeah.
Interesting. Baal Tolan. What's Baal Tolan?
Okay.
You probably look on your phone and Google.
She was thinking
of
Google.
I know. I know.
She stopped herself.
It's crazy what we can look up on. I look up everything on Google now. If I'm looking for a verse, instead of, before I take my concordance off the shelf, which I still use my concordance, but before I do that, if I know a phrase of the verse, not just the word, I just type it into Google. In English, and it almost always takes me right to the verse.
Wow.
And then I have the actual verse, and I can then look it up in Hebrew if I want, or online I can just type in Hebrew Bible in that verse, and it comes up in Hebrew.
Wow.
So it's really amazing.
Great.
Yeah.
I know.
It's just shocking what you can find.
Right now, I just heard the statistic that there is as much information on Facebook today, Facebook only, as there was on the internet 5 years ago, on the whole internet.
Wow. That's like, I can't comprehend.
No, it is beyond comprehension.
I can't comprehend.
Just Facebook has as much information as the internet has.
Yeah.
I cannot comprehend that.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
Well, anyway, the other thing that is interesting about this is that there was also the idea of if the worker doesn't have... how is it? You can take their cloak or something, but you have to give it back to them.
That's for loans. That's for pledges. For pledges.
Okay.
So let's say the worker, the poor person comes to you, right, to borrow money, and he has no collateral.
Right.
He only has what he sleeps in at night and what he wears during the day. You can take his night garment as collateral, but you have to return it to him at night to sleep in.
Exactly. I mean, it's the same concept.
To have that sensitivity to people who are that poor.
And the fact is that it's written down so that we don't just assume we're nice people and we're going to do that.
Right. Because
especially
Right, because, so there are certain laws in here that really are not a chiddush. They're not new. It's not that you need Judaism or Torah necessarily to tell you that's the right thing to do, to be honest, to pay on time. However, A, it makes it into a mitzvah. And B, once there's the halacha about it, there are halachic parameters. What does it mean to pay on time? On time means before 24 hours passes. Right. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that week, and it doesn't mean that second. You're not transgressing if you don't pay that second.
Pay every hour.
Right? Every hour.
Who's working?
Although it seems like mm-hmm. that every day that passes is a separate transgression. Mm-hmm. So the first day is a biblical transgression, and after that's a rabbinic transgression, every single day that passes that you didn't pay.
But if you've made a deal,
that's fine.
Month,
that's fine.
Then
and the employee...
Once the employee comes and says, you know, please pay me. Once they agree, that's fine. So you're paying on the first of the month or the last of the month, that's fine. But you got to pay that last of the month. Right? So...
Yeah.
Right.
Do you pay Thai every week?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I always have.
Every week or every week. Session?
Every week.
Right. So, and then you have to, once a week. And then you have to, say you're going away, but they're still coming into your house. They water your plants, they dust, mm-hmm. whatever you need, that stuff, right? So then you can say, I'm going away next week. Would you like me to pay you in advance? Would you like me to leave it on the fridge? Or would you like me to pay you for both weeks when I come back? Then they can tell you what it is, and you do that, right? But you do need to make that arrangement. You can't just say, I'll pay you when I get back. You have to get them to agree. Yeah, whatever the agreement is.
I'm just paying Ty because he's a very bad villain, and I don't want to have to try and figure out how much I owe.
He doesn't uh-huh. know at all. Anymore.
I know. I just pay him, and I always mm-hmm. know I'm
feeling
then you're done.
I mean, that's also the good thing about doing that. Then you, as the person who is right. doing the hiring, never have to say, gee,
sorry.
Did I pay? Didn't I pay?
Right.
Do I owe? Don't I owe? If you always pay, then you know.
Right, then
good.
You know. And that's good
because
it turns out that the worker actually has more legitimacy than the employer when it comes to wage discrepancies.
So you're saying if there's a dispute?
If there's a dispute, it's generally the worker's more trusted. He has to take an oath to say he wasn't paid. But we assume that the employer is busy with many things and might lose track.
Might misremember.
Whereas the one who the money is due him, he remembers, I worked 10 and I didn't get paid for that 10 and you owe me that 10. Whereas the employer is thinking, you know, I was busy with, like, you know, I think I'm pretty sure I paid you. But meanwhile, that's because they sat down and paid all their credit card bills, but they didn't pay that bill. But they're just mixed up. So we do rely on the worker, except for we do require him to take an oath just to make sure that he's not lying. But in general, we rely on the worker for that.
I have a problem because I paid my yard people in October, and the check is not cashed yet, and I haven't been able to reach them.
Right. Well, so that is up to them. That is something, but that is up to them.
But I don't want them right. to have lost it right. and not get paid for it because they didn't
right.
work. So that's a problem. I'm trying to reach them to say, why didn't you cash my check?
Mm-hmm.
Totally. Oh, I have right. one of those. Yeah, I've got one hanging out
yeah.
so that I
yeah,
need to
I've
follow
got
up.
Yeah, I've got to deal with
right.
I also have a tzedakah check that either didn't get there or didn't get cashed.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, the prohibition on cursing any Jew, man or woman. So there's a prohibition to curse any Jew.
I mean, it's you could curse other people?
Yes, it does.
Well, that doesn't seem quite right.
It does mean that it's, what it means is that it's not an Iser D'oraisa to curse another human being.
But the rabbis
But it is an Iser D'oraisa to curse another Jew. So now it's interesting to look at. There's two reasons why you're not allowed to curse that's discussed here. So I just gave you some vocabulary words here, and we'll talk about unklus too. So machloket. So everybody knows machloket means an argument, mm-hmm. right? And the root of the word is chelek. As opposed to shalom, where the root of the word is shalem. Shalom is wholeness, and machloket, argument, is parts. It just means parts, right? So you're separating something out from what could be whole into pieces. And then I just gave you another vocabulary word here, cholik. Cholik is like the verb, right? Machloket is the noun, that's an argument. Cholik, if I'm being cholik on you, that's how you say it in English, I'm cholik on you, right? So I am taking exception to what you say. I'm cholik, right? Or a sage could be cholik. So here we're going to see that that emotion, this is the fascinating thing to see here. Emotionally, the author of this book believes one thing. But intellectually, he's committed to following the path of the Rambam. So he brings what works for him emotionally, and then he brings the Rambam, and then he says, this is a machloket, these two things. But since I'm committed to following the Rambam, we're going to go with his words. But he brings the other full statement. He could not bring it. He doesn't have to say it. If he's going to solve it by following the Rambam,
he could just
skip that, right? Right. But let's see what he has to say on page 53. Right. So it's clear why you shouldn't curse somebody. It's not good to curse somebody. So maybe it's not clear why you shouldn't curse somebody. But you shouldn't, right? So the question is why? Why shouldn't you curse somebody?
Are you saying somebody or are you saying Jew?
Only Jew.
This is a Jew. Why shouldn't you curse that person?
Although he does mention both Jewry and other peoples in the first full paragraph.
In the first full paragraph, right? So
we know generally from all people in the world that they are fearful about curses.
Right.
Both Jewry and other people are fearful.
So what we're saying is that there is a universal consciousness that cursing is bad. And so why is it bad? Cursing is bad because maybe something bad will happen to you if you get cursed.
Like the evil-eyed thing.
Right. So what will happen if you get cursed? Right. So universally we understand that people don't want to be cursed. Right, that is something that Jews and non-Jews get. That's what he's saying in the first paragraph. So we understand it's bad. The question is, why is it bad? And that's where the machloket is. So first we can look at, the third paragraph down on page 53. Now we could possibly say, by the paucity of our understanding, that's a common phrase in Hebrew, la'aniyat dati, right, according to the paucity of my understanding, ve'efshar lanu lomar lefi aniyut datenu, according to the paucity of our understanding, it's plural here, inasmuch as the spirit that speaks in man is a supernal element, as it is written, and he breathed into his nostrils the soul of life. Okay, so now we have this verse. So why is it bad to curse? Because he has to set this logical thing up first. The pasuk says, the verse says, he breathed into his nostrils the soul of life. Now, Unklus, it translates the Torah into Aramaic, but he has an interpretive translation. According to Rabbi Yoel Unger, he believes that Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan's Living Torah translation is similar in that it's interpretive, and he feels almost prophetic, that it's such a translation
insightful.
Into English, so insightful and so based on things, such a good translation, that it's similar in a way to Unklus's, which is really seen as an authoritative translation because it's interpretive. So he sometimes doesn't translate exactly literally. He translates in a way that helps you understand what's being said.
And now Rabbi Wagner translated Unklus into English.
Oh, really? I'd
love to
see that.
Yeah, he's a 5-volume.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
He just finished publishing the last one.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'd love to see that. Okay, so Unklus translates a living spirit, right? Because it says, and he breathed into his nostrils the soul of life, and man became a living spirit. V'haya l'nefesh chaya, right? But Unklus translates that into a talking spirit, meaning what he's saying is that the essence of being a living spirit, a nefesh chaya, is that you can talk. That's the distinguishing feature between animals and humans, is the ability to talk. And even when we talk about the levels of existence, we talk about, I'll do them in Hebrew first, domim, tzomeach, chai, medaber. Domim is inanimate, so rocks, water, domim. Chai, alive thing, or tzomeach, really, blossoming things, plant
so like
life.
Plants.
Right. Chai, it's animals or other kind of
like, alive.
Midaber.
Speaking.
Humans.
Yeah.
Yisrael.
Yeah.
Above that. anyway, so that's what it's saying, is that the essence of being human is the ability to speak. So, therefore, we know and see constantly that according to the significance and worth of a human spirit and its adherence to supernal entities, to the spirits of the righteous and the pious, his words are swift to take effect in regard to whatever he speaks about. So speaking means something. Koach hadibur. Hashem created the world through speech. Then he gave human beings speech, which means that speech means something. So this is something accepted and widely recognized among those who know wisdom and understand knowledge. So you don't want to, if you say something, you might actually hurt somebody. That's what it's saying. Don't curse, because your words have power. Right?
Well, didn't we learn that with Luzzatto? You know, uttering, you know, any kind of a bad thing kind of sticks
it
to your
own
soul.
Right.
It creates a force, a negative force.
Right, the negative.
Right, so, okay, so there. So now the question is... Right, so now, which we're going to get to in a few mitzvahs, but now, so the question is, what... So there's three, really, things here. One is, it could actually hurt the person, because your words mean something, right? Two is, in this paragraph, it could be said further, that it's a matter of stopping contention among people and having peace rule among them. For a bird of the heaven will carry the voice, and the words of the one who uttered the malediction will perhaps come to the ears of the one he cursed. So, problem one, it could actually hurt somebody because you have koach hadibur. Problem two, it could hurt feelings, right? Because even if you curse privately, a bird may carry that. A little bird could tell the person what you said, and it can hurt feelings. But Rambam says, he's cholik, he says that it's in order that the spirit of the one uttering the curse should not be moved to vengeance. So starting with words, you
like
can
if
then
you put something into words, then it
yeah, you can
real.
It, right.
It escalates.
Nor should he accustom it to rage, right? And so you shouldn't be doing things that help you engage in negative behavior. And speech is the beginning of that. He continued at length about this, about the theme in his work. Well, it appears to me from his words that to his mind he sees no harm in store for the cursed person from the malediction.
Meaning he's looking at the
person
he does
who not
utters
right
the words.
Right. It is only that the Torah prohibits the matter for the sake of the one uttering the curse, so that he should not accustom his spirit to vengeance and anger and a denigration of character traits. Let us accept all the words of our master Rambam, even though our heart holds more strongly to what we have written.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
So he's basically saying, you know, let's...
There's a bunch of stuff going on here. We're going to have to accept what the Rambam says. So the Rambam is saying a curse doesn't actually hurt somebody. But other people do say, yeah, it hurts the speaker. Right. It's an Avera. It hurts the speaker. So besides the fact that you get the Avera from it.
The reality is, just logic, is it's both.
Right, right.
I mean, that logic says to me that it's really both.
That it hurts the speaker and it hurts the person?
Yes.
Right.
Or it has the potential to hurt the person.
If it hurts their feelings. But let's say, is there a reality of the curse where if you utter the curse in private, let's say nobody hears you, right? Nobody hears you at all. That it could hurt the, it for sure hurts the speaker.
That it could hurt the other person.
It could hurt the cursed.
I don't know.
Will it hurt the cursed?
I don't know. If there's no way that it would ever get to them.
So it can't be that it hurts their feelings.
No, it's not that. Yeah, so the question is, does it create
does it actually create?
This goes
right.
Back to
does it actually create? Yeah. Right,
this is,
right.
This goes back
to the whole
energy. Right, right, right.
We should post this in Beth Shemesh.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah, so I think we should.
Big problems over there.
That is
big problems over there.
Yelling and screaming at
just awful.
Well, think about if this came up, think about what
yesterday.
They put on yellow stars pretending that they were Holocaust.
The Haredi ones or the, yeah? Yeah,
you know,
disgusting.
Well, and if you think about it, if we're hearing about it with this child, you know that it's happening in other situations that haven't been reported.
Well, Beit Shemesh is unique, and
well,
I hope it stays unique. It's extra
that
bad.
Even. I'm saying maybe to other people.
It does happen, but in small. But this is huge. It's much bigger than other places. But
My daughter had rocks thrown at her in Israel.
Right,
she was a teenager.
Right. Yeah. So that has happened. Beryl Wine said, "You know, why do you think the Arabs throw rocks at us?" He said, "We create pathways with our behavior." Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean,
who picked up the first rock, you know?
Yeah, literally, they threw rocks at her.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right,
and
literally,
that's
happened.
And you know what?
It totally affects
her and her attitudes and feelings as a result.
It does. Rabbi Abitan, Alav HaShalom, our rabbi in Long Beach, used to say, like, nobody ever became Shomer Shabbos because he had a rock thrown at him.
Right.
You know, that never happened.
No, exactly.
Never.
But
right.
I mean... But it's think about them, and this is a religious child. I mean, this is not a
right. She's an Orthodox child.
Right.
She wasn't a tank top.
Let's say she wasn't.
Yeah.
Let's say she wasn't a tank top. It would be okay. It wouldn't be okay.
No. Right.
It would not be okay.
But even I mean, this is
right.
so extreme. I mean,
it's
she
so extreme. It's ridiculous. But that's the same sect where their women are wearing veils and the shawls.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
The shawls and the veils.
I did hear about that. I didn't hear.
That's
about
us. It's completely us. It's absolutely.
You came back from Israel.
Yeah. It's just. It's. Yeah, it's anti-Torah. It's anti-Tznius and it's anti-Torah.
It's going to get there. It's going to spread. Just like it needs to be, right. keep going down and down.
Well, it needs to just be stopped. I mean, and I hope it will, because there are plenty of people who are coming out pretty strongly saying this is absolutely wrong and there's no place for violence at all whatsoever anywhere in our Torah. It's not acceptable.
I don't understand how they ever get to the point of justification in their minds that it's
so, okay. So the answer to that is Yetzer Hara. Okay, so the Yetzer Hara attacks you where you are vulnerable.
And they are vulnerable.
So there's they're not vulnerable to a bacon cheeseburger. Mm-hmm. So the Yetzer Hara can't have them walk past a trafe place where it smells delicious, and they're going to even think for a second that they're going to walk in. Not for a second.
Right.
But if the Yetzer Hara comes all dressed up as a pious, righteous Jew and says, you're going to allow this to happen in your neighborhood? Well, that must mean you're not from, you're tolerating the breach of halacha within your neighborhood. You must go do something about it. That's the Yetzer Hara coming at that Jew's vulnerable point.
Okay, very good.
So
but back to this, the cursed versus the cursee, curser. Mm-hmm. This is sort of like that whole field of study, neurolinguistic programming, where you behave the way you speak. You know, we've raised all these negative children because what do we say to them? No, 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 no.
But Judaism,
they need to be hearing
that.
No.
I mean, Judaism, I mean, it's the idea that if
the way you speak.
Yeah.
I mean,
that speech makes a difference.
Exclusively that speech makes a difference, but behavior and actions. I mean, I remember, you know, if you do something wrong, it's easier to do it wrong the next time.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I'm accustomed to it. I mean, so we don't believe that.
And as to this one, it's like if I curse another Jew who never finds out about it, I now start behaving.
Right. So that's what he's saying here, right?
To that, because of the whole NLP.
Right.
Thing.
So that's what he's saying. You shouldn't curse because you shouldn't accustom your spirit to vengeance and anger. That the speech accustoms your spirit.
And you know what? It's
to vengeance and anger.
Totally true. I was working years ago in construction. I was building houses and stuff, and my speech became a little bit like
less refined.
Yes, shall we say. Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I mean, it's true. I mean, I could see it was creeping in, and finally I said, this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and my father always used to say to me, you know, even not swearing, but using words in an inappropriate fashion or whatever, that it's lazy. You know, you just
lazy. Huh.
Yeah, he just said, you know,
you don't
use your words
right
and, you know, and speak properly. And I mean, he would say, you know,
it's interesting the different ways parents have, because my mother worked on me in high school, right, when I was learned all those new words, right? And she would tell me, it's so not beautiful. You're such a beautiful girl. It's unbecoming to use language like that. Didn't help because I was so cool that language was very important. Uh-huh. But as soon as I converted, she's like, are these the words a daughter of Israel should be using? Oh.
That got you.
And I was like, I guess
thanks,
not.
Mom. Thanks, Mom.
She wasn't
totally.
Jewish,
I know.
Jewish,
I know. She totally
she
got me. But that's good, a lazy one, because he knew you, right? You're not lazy.
Right.
So if he'd say that's a father's tactic to figure you out, right? So that's the opposite of the Yetzer Hara, who knows you, right? Will attack you in your space. But so your father knew you and got you,
and it worked,
right?
It worked.
And it worked, right? Yeah, that's good. That's good.
What about when a small child, you know, really, you know, a two-year-old, you know, goes, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. You know, as a parent, the first time you feel bad, and then you go, okay, fine. You know, you're
well,
still
so it depends.
Go to bed and take a nap.
Right, right. You do still want to enforce the rules, but some parents get very upset by the I hate you, and some parents forbid kids from saying it. And some parents, you know, I think I mean, personally, it does hurt, but hopefully what you could hear is what's being said, not the words that are being used.
Angry.
Right?
Why
so you're angry.
Angry
right. You're angry with me. I'm telling you to do something you don't like, and you're very angry. That's the way you express it. Maybe you do hate me right now. You know, I once told one of my kids I hated them.
And I
immediately, you know, said, oh, I hate what you're doing. But the truth is, I did hate him in that moment. I did.
It's true.
And I had to sit down with him afterwards. You know, he was 13 years old and he was doing something absolutely, you know,
inappropriate.
Totally. And I had to sit down with him later and say, yeah, no, it's true. I did. In that moment, I hated you. I mean, I love you too. And you crossed a line. And yeah.
And it really was the behavior, but it's impossible almost as a person to separate.
Well, when the behavior can be very regular, you could come to a place. Yeah, it was rough. Yeah, it was a whole big thing.
And where does the line draw when you really, you know, somebody's behavior towards you is so consistently bad.
Right, so then some.
Hateful.
Right.
Hateful that you know, I guess the Torah way of it is just you just walk away.
Well,
you have a relationship.
You could, yeah, and you're not permitted to hate. That's one of the
right.
mitzvahs.
See,
not allowed
problem.
To hate your brother in your heart, right? Mm-hmm. Lo tisna. So you're supposed to correct them. Where it says don't hate, it also says correct, right? Correct somebody. So and don't carry sin because of them, and don't hate them. So you're supposed to talk about it. It's not just walk away, because then you'll continue to hate. Right? Because then you're just like, I can't stand you. I'm not going to be in a relationship at all. You know, better you should say, I have a really hard time being in a relationship with you. I don't like the way that you behaved. And, you know, if you're going to continue to behave this way, I'm going to have to distance myself because I am choosing not to hate.
Whatever.
Right? Mm-hmm. But it's hard. Well, yeah.
And I think that also a lot of the psychology things talk about that kind of emotion as a not a primary emotion. I mean, I think that that's valuable and very consistent with all of this.
That
is hate, for example, is probably based by and large on being hurt.
You know, well, so there's an initial hate and then there's a harboring hate.
Yeah.
There's a very big difference between that initial feeling of I hate you, right?
Yeah.
Feeling like the 2-year-old, right? You're cutting me off, I hate you. That's one feeling, and which you probably could rephrase. It's probably not actual hate. Probably I'm really mad at you, or I'm really hurt by you. I'm expressing difficulty, which is different than hating somebody, where you harbor hatred that you've thought about it. You know, it's that person is just rotten, bad to the bone. There's nothing good about him, and I hate him no matter what, and I never want them in my life, in my house, in my orbit. I don't want to think about them. But meanwhile, you're spending so much energy thinking about them.
So you can't do that. So what?
That's
happens
not permitted.
Let's think about just. In an environment, because I just finished a book that was about World War II, and it wasn't about the Germans, it was about the Japanese. But
the rape of Nanking?
No, this is one about the rain, something about the rain. So, at any rate. But people who, you know...
You are permitted to hate Rishayim.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
you are permitted to hate Rishayim.
So you're, okay.
Yeah, definitely.
The Nazis,
the Japanese.
People
I mean, who can not hate... Somebody who tortured like the Japanese tortured.
Right.
I mean, yes, you can hate them. Yeah, and
but I think the problem is that you want to take it and you want to say, well, that 25-year-old that I'm doing business with across this table is the grandson of somebody who...
Oh, so then you're not going to hate that person. But you can hate the Russia that did it.
Yeah.
You could hate the grandfather. You could hate the culture that produced it,
right.
too.
That's what I was thinking of so much was the culture of particular situations that created...
It is culture, but culture does not exist in a vacuum. We have to take responsibility for that. You know, just like the same way that you could say road rage, mm-hmm. is that a way to defend yourself? It's not really. It is because we have a culture of road rage, but we all have to take responsibility individually for that, for our own behavior, but also for the culture because mm-hmm. we all contribute to that culture.
Right.
You know,
well,
so
the classic curse is Balaam, mm-hmm. you know, who Balak, the king asked mm-hmm. Balaam, the prophet, to curse mm-hmm. the Jewish people. Balaam basically could have gone either way. I mean, he was considered at a very high level, but the fact that he acceded and decided to do the cursing and then ultimately was not able to do it shows that...
So that it makes a difference, though.
It makes a difference,
that is a proof. That could be used as a proof text for...
Right. But, I mean, he didn't have any animosity initially. He was just ordered
his hired
to
guns.
Curse, you know, the Jewish people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, which is, I mean, it's definitely a story in the Torah that shows us that cursing makes a difference. Otherwise, who cares what he says? Who cares who hires him? Who cares?
That's true.
You know, if you're a hired gun and you're just going to go do what they say,
so this gets
who
back
cares?
To where we started, which is, does the curse
make a difference
never
or not?
Communicated, that is never known...
Right. Does it make a difference or not?
Does it make a difference to the cursee?
Right. Right.
And we're saying yes.
Right. That we are saying, yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that, so that's what the Sefer Chanukah is saying. That's why he says, I think it does, but Rambam is saying it doesn't. Now, Rambam is a rationalist, and I don't understand enough about him and his philosophy, but he does not believe, I was just reading recently about magic that Rambam was holding, so we've explained before in this class in the Sefer Chanukah, and there is a stream of consciousness that says, the Torah outlaws magic. It's not going to outlaw something that doesn't exist. So it must be that if there's an Iser, that there has to be something to it, right?
Yeah.
And Rambam says, don't be a fool that thinks that the reason why the Torah outlaws magic is because it actually exists. that outlaws it, so you shouldn't even think that you're going to go in that direction at all. The other nations do that. We should stay far away from their practices, but it doesn't outlaw it because it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. It outlaws it because you shouldn't
because
even
you shouldn't
go there ceremonially.
You shouldn't even look for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right. Right. So the Rambam holds absolutely differently. So he's holding differently here, too. He's saying that the actual curse doesn't make a difference to the one who's cursed, but it makes a difference to the one who curses. It's not good for them.
It seems to me that both things are true.
Right. And that's what it seems like to the Sefer Chinuch also.
Well, I think so,
you're good
true.
Company.
I think so, too.
Good. Excellent.
For whatever that's
right.
worth, I think so, too.
Right.
Everywhere, man and woman are.
Right. Okay. So we talked about Unclos a little bit and what he did, right, how he interpreted, and just, of course, everybody knows, but just to remind you that he is a ger, so it is an example of a ger making a important contribution in history. Unclos was a ger.
Oh,
yeah, Unclos is a ger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Unclos is a convert to Judaism, and he's printed in all the books. So anybody who says converts can't really teach, okay, we got Unclos right there.
Well, we know it's not true, so...
So I just wanted to point that out.
I mean, we're not learning.
He's one of my friends.
He's one of your friends.
He's not yet a friend. I mean, he's one of my siblings, but I'd like to be a friend. Maybe Rabbi Wagner's books could help. I do want to actually try to delve into the translation at some point.
Excellent. Yeah. I have read a little bit, but I don't.
Yeah, I'd love to get my hands on that because I do want to. I mean, it's Aramaic, so it's not something you can just jump into.
Yeah.
But I think with the English, you could start to learn the Aramaic that way. So I would like to. That is one of my projects for eventually.
Obviously he did it, I think, just to make it a lot more accessible.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be interested to see it.
It was like a 10-year project.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's a big contribution.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that is a real contribution to the field of Jewish understanding and knowledge. Okay, 232. Not to make a trusting person stumble through misleading advice. So.
And again, it says Israelites.
Not to bring Israelites to grief by giving them bad counsel, but we should rather guide them aright when they ask advice by what we believe to be an honest way and a good plan. As it is stated, nor should you put a stumbling block before the blind. So that's different. It's two different psukim. That's lifnei iver lo titein mechshol, before a blind person, don't put a mechshol, a stumbling block. And here is shelo lachshil tam bederech, don't make a trusting person or a simple person stumble by giving bad advice. So somebody comes to you for advice. Yesterday somebody came over and they were telling me a business plan they have. They want to open a restaurant and this and that and the other thing. They didn't say, how should I invest my time and money? Because I would never have said restaurant. They said, I want to open a restaurant, right?
So they started from that.
They started from that place. So they wanted help thinking of menus and stuff like that. So that's one thing. So it would be wrong to say, why don't you try, you know, making super hot food and just see what people can take, right? And call it hot stuff, right? And that would be bad advice because you can't serve as many people that way, right? So you shouldn't do that, even though that would be hot stuff
possible.
Would be a different type of a restaurant. It would be its own niche, you know. So, but let's say he was coming for advice. How should I best make a parnasa? This is the money that I have, the time that I have, and the skill that I have. It would be foolish to say.
And here's something I'm thinking about.
It would be foolish to say start a restaurant since you know anybody who's done any. I haven't done research.
Oh my gosh.
That like 9/10
like
fail.
The worst ever.
Yeah, it's like it's basically.
Of course, he was considering a kosher restaurant.
Actually, this person wasn't, because they failed.
That's a better chance.
Right. But still
so,
bad.
Even so.
Even in
so.
The TREIF world, they fail very frequently.
Huge. Terrible business.
Yeah. So you should not give them that advice.
So going back here, this starts out not to bring Israelites. So are we saying this, again, only applies to Jews?
So he does stay here later that it does apply to everybody. I mean, you shouldn't do that.
Equally forbidden to mislead an
Yeah, you're not allowed to mislead. Because this is about misleading. You shouldn't give them bad advice. But this is actually two things. It's not so, that's why I wrote the one and the two. So A is to not give them bad advice, so to proactively advise them something that's wrong. But B is to not put something in their hand that's wrong for them. So the example that he gives is don't hand a nazir a glass of wine. Right? Because he's not blind. He's not simple. You know, so how does that fit into this? A nazir knows he's not permitted to have wine. But you shouldn't offer it to him. You shouldn't make it easy for him to have something that's forbidden.
So like offering an alcoholic a drink.
Right, you should not offer an alcoholic a drink. But even possibly, and it depends, I don't know exactly where the halachic parameters are, should you offer a diabetic a piece of cake? Right.
And that happens a lot.
It does happen a lot. So it's one thing I think. I mean, again, halachic parameters. There is a halacha. I don't know what it is exactly, where the line is. Let's say you're serving a Shabbos meal. You happen to know that one of your guests is diabetic. You could offer everybody dessert. You don't have to say, does everybody except for Chaim want dessert? You don't have to do that. But you might want to make sure that you have fresh fruit and chocolate or just fresh fruit for dessert, right? Especially, let's say, if you know that person's weak. If you know they're weak, you probably should just put fresh fruit on the table or not. Just bench and say, this week we're not having dessert, you know, going forward. But certainly not to say, oh, Chaim, I made the best pavlova. I just got a recipe from Australia. Why don't you try it? Why don't you try it? This is worth it. Try it. You for sure shouldn't be doing that to a diabetic. And then the question of somebody on a diet, whatever. Look, there's all kinds of questions. Where does that go to? I don't know the answer to all that, but it's something to think about. We're not supposed to put a stumbling block.
That, in a way, is being aware of, sensitive to, a person in terms of what their weaknesses might be, or, I mean, as you said, it's probably a whole continuum.
Right.
But you could expand it into all kinds of things.
Right.
Not just offering food or, you know, I mean, it really talks about trying to be aware of another person and sensitive to
and not cause them to fail in whatever way. Right. We shouldn't be the one who causes somebody else to fall.
We should be supportive to the extent possible.
And not the opposite. Both.
Right.
Should be supportive and not the opposite. We shouldn't make it easier for them to fall through our advice or through our behavior.
Yeah, right.
So not to make it to cause them to stumble. They might not fall.
No,
right? But stumble. Right. We shouldn't cause them to stumble. We should not be the stumbling block in front of somebody.
It's interesting he mentions in here, in this vein, the sages of blessed memory taught that when one lends and another borrows at interest, that it's here, that's here.
Well,
both violate the injunction not to put a stumbling block before the blind.
Meaning, right, so meaning you have,
the interest.
Well, it's usser. So later, somewhere else there's a mitzvah not to have interest.
I'm surprised that it's here.
So what it's saying is, if you come to me and say, I want to borrow and I'll pay you 10% interest, that's just putting a stumbling block before me. Because now I'm thinking, if I say yes, I'm going to get 10%.
But it's wrong.
But you making the offer is a stumbling block. That's what it's saying. Or if I say I lend at interest, right? So then also I'm now putting a stumbling block before you. You need to borrow, right? So you're thinking, because taking interest and paying interest, yeah, paying it and taking it are both separate averas. So somebody who agrees to lend an interest is causing a stumbling block before the person who needs to borrow. And somebody who's offering to borrow at interest is putting a stumbling block before the lender. That's what it's saying. This is not bringing the isur of interest. This is just saying making the offer in either direction is creating a stumbling block for the other person.
Well, I guess that's perceived as misleading advice.
Right. Oh, so it's saying stumbling block. So this is a little bit bigger than the misleading advice, right?
This is the stumbling block, yeah.
Right, so you're not supposed to do that. Right.
That it was here.
So this means...
As an example.
Right, so it's a little bit larger.
This page was more interesting.
Pardon?
I think the one on the next page about weapons of war is even more interesting.
Right. So that is fascinating. That you're not allowed... So included in this, right? That's great, yeah. Among the laws of the precept is what the sages of blessed memory taught at the beginning of Tractate of Avodah Zarah, that about matters directly before the blind we're careful, but about matters before we're not commanded. Where does it say that?
It's
before that?
Sentence. It's forbidden to sell any weapon of war or anything
59.
Which can bring harm to many, to the heathen.
Or to the Jew, or to the bandit.
Unless.
Right. Well, it's to defend us.
To defend yourself.
Yeah.
Right. So the Americans in Afghanistan, when the Afghanis were fighting the Russians, right? So we armed the Afghanis because
the Taliban.
Yes. Yeah.
But they weren't defending us. They weren't protecting us.
No.
Well, it was in a way we wanted them to win because we didn't want Russia to win because we didn't want to have another communist state which protects American interests, which is why we armed them. That was the thought. But that's what this is saying, is you got to be super careful.
A little bit convoluted.
Right. So you're not allowed to send, right. So there's a concept of before, which we'll look at in a second. And then there's this concept here. So on page 59, we'll skip the before for a second. So you're not allowed to, right, a stumbling block. No weapons of war to those people who might use them inappropriately, right? You can't sell anything. So, and that's, so certainly it does say weapons of mass destruction, doesn't it, here?
Just weapons of war.
I think it said something more. Anything which can bring harm, or anything which can bring harm to many.
Many, yeah.
To many.
Which is like mass.
Right, so weapon of war is a sword at that time,
true.
Right? Yeah. Harm to many would is be a weapon of mass destruction, something that will harm more than that. Right, so that could be at that time that's poisoning the well. You can't sell them poison that will be that concentrated that if you pour it into the well, many can be harmed. Right, so you can't sell that poison. Right, so you can't do that. So that is a weapon of greater destruction than one. It's not just a gun. It's not just a sword. But you can't even sell a gun or a sword to somebody who's to a non-Jew.
Right,
or to a Jewish thief.
Right.
Or to somebody who's going to use it for negative things. You can't do that.
You have really no control over what they...
Because you have no control. Right.
Exactly.
Because they turn around and they sell this stuff. Mm-hmm.
Right, which is why you should know.
Something, right, and once you sell something, you're absolutely right.
Well, it says, so too is it forbidden to sell such equipment to an Israelite who will then sell it to a heathen, and likewise to an Israelite bandit. Mm-hmm. So you can't sell it to a Jew that already has a bad reputation. They're a bandit.
Like,
and you can't sell it to somebody like who's going to sell
dealer.
It.
A Jewish arms dealer.
Right.
Which I'm sure there are some.
Yes. Land. Yes, there are, sadly. So you cannot sell it to a Jewish arms dealer because you don't know where they're going to sell it. So it's not
Rich, remember Mark Rich?
Right, we don't, right. So we're not going to go there. They should all do tshuva.
Yeah, they should all.
And there are certain things. There are certain things you can't do tshuva from when you've unleashed this, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say you sold that, right?
And,
you can't do tshuva from that
because
you don't know, right? Yeah, you don't know who bought all those guns. You sold 30 guns, right? Now, who was killed from that? How can you find the families and go apologize for the fact that the Mexican drug runners killed their mother and now all the children are orphans? Right? You can't do tshuva from that. It's not that you mayn't. You may.
It's that it's
physically It's that you
possible.
Can't, right? You cannot.
You can't make it right.
Right. You cannot. So, right, so you have to be careful with that. But it also talks about the lifnei, before. Back a page, is that you don't have to worry about before, you just have to worry about before. So where is that? Let's see. You can't put a stumbling block before the blind, but you don't have to worry about before. So what's that example? Let's see.
Oh, here, it's in the first sentence.
Talking about idol worshippers.
Among 57.
Right. Among the laws of the precept is that we start that you can't put the law something before the blind. Therefore, it was explained there that when asked in the Talmud whether the reason of the Mishnah, so the Mishnah has a isur that you can't sell things, can't do business with idol worshippers 3 days before their sacred holiday. So that's a halacha, right? Not allowed to do business with an idol worshipper 3 days before their holiday, right? Why? Because they might use the stuff that you did business with them for. They might either use the money or they might use the stuff that they bought to go, they bought a goat from you. Now they're going to go sacrifice that. So you sold them the thing they're going to sacrifice, right? So you're not allowed to do that. You know that three days before is close enough to their sacred festival that whatever they're selling.
Intended consequences.
Unintended consequences. But you know, but it's likely consequences.
Right. I'm saying it's the opposite.
Right.
It's like foreseeable risk.
Right. So it seems that is the reason that you can't do that. Now, continuing in this, before the second, that they will go and give thanks, parenthetically, to their idol for the business transaction that they did, or so as not to put a stumbling block before the blind. The doubt about the Mishnah's reason is only about doing business with them, whereby the Israelite gives the heathen something suitable for an offering. Right? So if the Israelite sells them the goat, that's the problem. I think, though, if you...
But you could sell a goat if it wasn't right before a
Yeah, if
holiday.
It's not right before the holiday, you can't. In such a case, it's possible that the injunction about a stumbling block before the blind is involved. But as to the entire rest of the passage in the Mishnah, for instance, about lending or repaying them money or lending them things, which you're also probably not supposed to do, it's because he will go and give thanks that they're forbidden. For a stumbling block before the blind can't be said to be involved here, because if you borrowed something, you can't offer it up.
Right.
And if you lend it or repaid money, they don't offer coins either. The coins are not suitable for an offering. Then what would you say? Perhaps they'll buy an offering with those coins.
That's
before the before. You don't have to worry about that. You can repay the loan. But it's saying before the before, right? You can't sell them the goat 3 days before.
But you could loan them the money.
But you can repay money you borrowed from them.
Right. Or loan them
because
money.
Or loan them money. Because you don't have to say...
What are they going to do with the money?
What are they going to do with the money? That's before the before. They didn't get the goat yet. You don't have to go that far.
Right.
But you can't put it before them.
Right.
Don't sell them the goat. But to repay the loan or to... Right. That you're permitted to do. Because you don't have to worry about before the before. Just the before is your what you have to worry about. Right. Except
well,
for weapons.
Said,
that's
true.
Why the weapons
yeah.
follows it.
Because it's the... But like I said, that is sort of the law, shall we say, of foreseeable consequences. If you leave something in a dangerous spot where
right.
there's lots of traffic, you can imagine that something bad might happen. Because, but if it's in a place where nobody ever goes or...
Right, then you don't have to worry. Right.
So it's, if you can anticipate, so this would be the same thing. And also it applies just before the holiday. So
right.
if you sold somebody or gave somebody or whatever the goat,
goat.
A month before, well,
right.
maybe they're going to eat it. Maybe they're going to get
right.
milk. Maybe they're going
to... Right, you have no clue. You don't have to say, oh, this
what
is a baby goat.
Do? Are they going to hang on to it for
right.
a month and then sacrifice
right.
it?
Right, right. You don't have to say that. That's correct.
Interesting.
Okay, 233, not to pervert justice in a civil judgment. Okay, so this is interesting. So it says the root purpose of this is known... Second paragraph, by all for it's evident by for by righteous judgment the settled community of human beings endures. So this really it doesn't say in this one, but the setting up courts of justice is one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. Right, there's six don'ts and one do, and the do for Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach is set up courts of justice. So it's just clear that when there's courts that enforce the law, everything runs better, and so that's an obvious thing. So this, again, is not something that the Torah comes to add to human society. It just makes it a mitzvah so that you get the spiritual connection through doing what makes society run well. Okay, so you're not so... It's interesting. It says, be deliberate in judgment. So be careful in judgment. Don't distort a judgment or don't do anything that will lead to a distortion in judgment. And that's why we're not allowed to give bribes or take bribes because it will lead to a distortion in judgment. So it's saying a person should be very careful. A person should try not to have to sit in judgment because it's so hard to do this. But somebody, and if they are going to do it, they should be a wise person. Somebody has to do it, so they should be wise. But at the end of the second paragraph, our sages of blessed memory said, too, that it's fitting for a person judging a case to take counsel with someone greater than himself if there is one. So they should know. And nobody should be gaivadik enough to be prideful enough to think that they know it and see it clearly. They should just check in with somebody else if they have the opportunity to do that.
I once asked David Richman if all of his study helped him as a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I imagine it would, because you do think differently.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is interesting. Whoever keeps himself away from sitting in judgment keeps himself away from enmity, robbery, and vain oaths, right? So you don't want to have to sit in judgment if you don't have to. But if you do have to, you have to. But whoever doesn't do it will protect himself from all this negative stuff. All this to teach us that the matter needs patience and a great amount of calm reflection, so that one should not make an error in trying a case. For there are many ways to proceed in trials, and a case requires a very wise scholar. As our sages of blessed memory said, whoever would become wise, let him occupy himself with the civil laws on goods and possessions. That's not to be a judge, just study mm-hmm. in the civil laws, because there's no greater branch of the Torah. They're like a flowing wellspring. There's so much there to learn. And then the next paragraph is, you should be careful in a trial that involves hardly anything, a pruta, as much as you should be with a multi-million dollar trial. Right.
Very important.
Right. But then it says it's really actually a good idea to go for mediation if possible, or to try to effect mediation. Let's see. Where's that? It says, then because of the serious nature of the trial, they're very greatly pleased. A person who can achieve a compromise between the parties to the controversy who wish the trial. So it's good to try to achieve a compromise. To him, the verse applies, render truth and a judgment of peace. So because the judgment, this is a judgment of peace. So if you can mediate and get the sides to agree, that counts as a true judgment, because they both agreed, and peace, because it's not always peace when you render a true judgment.
Right.
Right? So here, that mediation where they both agree, that's the best. So it is said of David, and David rendered judgment and righteousness to all his people. What is judgment in which there is righteousness? You must say a compromise settlement. So that's the best if you can get to that. And if not, then you have to have the whole trial.
Is this a really long one?
This is long. So he's saying now, so let's look on page 63. This is interesting. If the subject would not be so long, meaning this segue that he's not going to go on, he'll just discuss one paragraph. If the subject would not be so long, taking us beyond the framework of our task, we would proceed to explain at length all the instances when a verdict is overturned and the instances when it's not overturned, the bet then being obligated to pay out of its own funds the wronged party. So that's an interesting thing.
So that gets to the thing that if a person is wrongly found guilty and imprisoned, for example, and then they subsequently discover the error, that he would be entitled to damages.
That's right. Right, he is entitled to damages.
And they do get damages.
Some do.
Mm-hmm. Some do, and not everybody does.
Not everybody does. But
most of them did.
I think it depends on a lot of factors.
Your lawyers.
I think it does depend on a lot of factors, because I think...
Whether
you know
they
the principle.
Were negligent when they convicted him. I mean, I think there's a lot of factors. If you
I
know,
just thought that they
because
served, you know,
I think for example,
years.
In those instances where the science
DNA has turned
exactly where the science has come to the point where a person mm-hmm. who I think in those instances they may not. Because at the time they were
recently that they did.
Yeah.
Well, so if the I think the idea is if they had a fair trial and
right.
everybody behaved
right.
appropriately
right.
according to what was available
and
at the time.
Can find a place where somebody did not.
But if they were all fair,
yeah.
then and then it's
right.
turned over 25 years later because science has changed, right?
Right.
Then they get their freedom. They don't get paid back because nobody did anything wrong.
I think that's
it was
right.
a fair and just trial.
Yeah.
However, if they find that the DA really wanted to convict, right,
and
he withheld the evidence
right.
from the other side or pressured somebody or whatever, then they get compensated.
Right. I think
it's
that's
interesting.
Right.
Almost
I think
all,
that's right.
all of the cases I've seen that they publicized, there has been misdeeds on either the police's part.
Miscarriage of justice,
yes,
shall
right.
we say.
Right.
There's a lot of that. Yeah.
Well, and that...
No.
And
in
that
some counties are worse.
It's a problem.
Too eager to have a vote.
That one in
I mean,
Illinois.
That leads you to question
you
everything.
Convince.
It does.
Right. Exactly.
Well, that leads you
and
to the
walked.
Question
right.
of how
it's
often has this occurred
yeah,
when we
I
don't even know
yes.
people are.
Right.
You know. I mean, it's very
right.
Right.
problematic
it's
to say
the
least. The
death penalty. I'm not off of it necessarily, but it certainly makes me think of it.
Right.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Whiplash. Go back to whiplash.
Yeah.
Right. Just like it says right here.
Right. So anyway, it does. There's all kinds of laws about if they transgressed this or that or the other thing, or they did it on purpose, or they weren't knowledgeable enough, and they went against the ruling of the Mishnah, or of a strong sage that followed the Mishnah, and the verdict was found to not comply with the earlier ruling like that, then they'll have to pay out of their own funds. However, that's for if it transgresses Mishnah. If it transgresses one of those sages, and they're themselves a great sage, and they can defend their position that was against an earlier sage, then they wouldn't have to pay.
So it's just a question of who's responsible
right.
for the overturning.
Right, right.
Right.
So there's lots of stuff
saying.
About the responsibility
right.
of it is that the... That it has to be, let's see, not to pervert.
But again,
right.
allowing for the change in the science or the facts or the...
Right.
Well, I think this is not, it's not saying that. It's not talking, because they didn't have the reality in which there'd be a change in the science. This would be saying, if somebody was fair, so we see if somebody wasn't fair, clearly, they're going to have to pay, out of their own funds, they now have to pay recompense, okay? So they transgressed this. Let's say somebody did it fairly, but they were ignorant. That's the question. Not ignorant of the science, because they didn't have the reality of science
right,
changing.
Right.
But they just didn't know enough to try the case. Or they didn't have permission to try the case. Right? That they set up, like, you know, a bunch of yeshiva bachrams set up their own Beit Din, and they try a case, and they didn't go to Rabbi Kagan and say, may we set up a Beit Din? It's really your auspices to examine this student, right? This we think this guy stole from our cholent pot, right? Mm-hmm. And they set up a Beit Din. Yeshiva boys could do that. They could just have learned something and, you know, do that kind of thing,
right?
That's the kind of thing that age does, right? So, and it's the kind of thing, unfortunately, that people might do in a city, too. They might not, excuse me, have proper jurisdiction. Three guys could get together and set up a Beit Din. If they didn't have... They didn't have proper knowledge, or they didn't have proper authority to try that case, then they would have to pay. Right, but let's
it's
say
interesting that the court has to pay. That's an
the
that's,
court has to pay.
I mean,
right,
that is interesting because
well,
that,
the well, court is the people who render
the court
judgment.
Is the people, right? Well,
and that's the state because the state picks the or a corporation, you know, whatever.
Right, right. Yeah, but you know, you would think it, it, you know, would it be the jurors?
But in
well, there's no jurors here.
No, but I'm jurors. Saying if we translated it into modern
no.
Time.
No, no,
it wouldn't. They're not liable.
They're officers. They become officers of the court.
Right.
When you're sworn in
they're
to be a juror.
They're
right.
Absolved of any
right.
Financial obligation. Right.
So that's where today it's a little more distant because even the judge isn't paying. This is where the judge pays out of his own pocket.
Because the judge,
because he had a miscarriage of justice. So it's much stronger deterrent that it comes out of the judge's own money. If he was ignorant or he took a bribe or whatever it was and he judged poorly or judged wrongly.
Not a bad
no, it's not a bad concept. I think there's an idea for that.
Might instigate a little bit of more judicial responsibility.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, because once you say it's the system that can be blamed, not me.
Who is the system?
Who's the system? So the state will be sued. Big deal. Look, that's no skin-off. My retirement's still intact. Right. Right, but they're not being affected directly.
Somebody else's problem.
Right, so it's not about that, right? So what was I going to end on this? I had something to say that just got lost. Let's see if I remember it. I don't think so. So we'll continue next week with, there's two more that have to do with trials and judges. But meanwhile, let's just take for our message into the week, mediation. Creating peace is the best thing to do. Rather than having to come to judgment, we'd rather bring it to a place of peace before it needs to be judged.
Very good. The word that we used at AT&T was